Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to share a free resource just for you. It's called 5 Ways to Connect with God. In our busy world, it's easy to feel spiritually dry, but this short guide introduces 5 timeless practices like one-phrase prayers, cultivating thankfulness, and meditating slowly on scripture. They can refresh your soul and draw you closer to God. You can download your free copy today at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. Now, let's get into today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And we're really pleased to say we've got a guest on the show today, which is Bob White. How are you doing today, Bob?
Oh, good to be speaking with you again. Yes, we've met in real life as well.
That's right.
Over the years, so it's really good to be speaking.
Well, it's great to have you on the show. For those who might not have come across you or your work before, do you want to just briefly explain a little bit about who you are and what you've done over your long and distinguished career?
Yes, well, I'm supposedly retired now, but my wife says I'm not, because I'm still doing fieldwork. I'm a geophysicist, which means I look at how the Earth works now. And I've spent my life partly working at sea on research ships, but over the last 20 years, mostly working in Iceland, looking at volcanoes and earthquakes. So when people ask me what I do, I say, well, I look at various disasters from earthquakes and volcanoes. But the main thing we're trying to do is use tiny little earthquakes to track where the molten rock is moving underground before it erupts. So you get some idea of where it's going to come out. And that's been very successful in Iceland because it's a very volcanically active island and a place I love too. Lovely people there. I've got really good friends there.
Yeah, Bob, it's great to have you as a sort of distinguished scientist. I don't think we've ever had a fellow of the Royal Society on our podcast before, so that's an enormous distinction. But I'm also very envious because your research studies take you to these wonderful parts of the world. You know, I worked as an academic research scientist, and my research took me into a sort of fusty basement in Gower Street where I spent many hours. So there are definite advantages in being a geoscientist.
There certainly are. And my colleagues ask me which conference I'm going to next, and it's always somewhere else in the world, and it's always somewhere geologically interesting. And a characteristic of geology conferences, you spend your 2 or 3 days in a lecture theatre, but then you have a field trip and the locals take you around, you know, the interesting geology around. So I've had just amazing field trips on La Reunion and South Africa and South America and Iceland and all sorts of places. And that's a real privilege, actually, to have somebody who really knows the place take you around and show you outdoors. And I guess that's what got me into the subject in the first place. I came to university to do physics, and to be honest, it was a bit hard. and you know, by the time you'd finished your physics degree, you'd got up to the physics they were doing in about 1950, right? Whereas the geology department, they all met together for coffee every day, staff, students, undergraduates, everything. And we, by our third year, we'd be discussing research papers. And indeed, a lot of the frontline research was being done by people in Cambridge, where I was. So it was far more exciting. Plus, I like being outdoors. So I like doing field work, and I still like doing field work. So, yeah, I've been very privileged to be paid to do something which I enjoy so much. And to be honest, to be paid to study God's creation, you know, what could be better than that?
By coincidence, my our 5-year-old daughter has got a particular interest in volcanoes over the last year or so. I don't really know where it came from. So we've ended up, you know, finding lots of kids' encyclopedias about volcanoes. And I've kind of, through reading them with her, picked up the barest surface levels, scratching the surface about how volcanoes work. Has, over your career, has our understanding of what is going on beneath our feet in the Earth, has it moved on significantly?
Oh, it has hugely, yes. So I came into this subject just at the beginning of the what was called the plate tectonics revolution, when people used to think about the Earth going up and down to make mountains and sedimentary basins and that sort of thing. And then in the late 60s, people realized things moved horizontally on the Earth, these things they call plates. And a lot of the action is happening where the plates join. So where they're pulling apart, you get all the volcanoes down the middle of the oceans, which you don't see, but you do see them in Iceland where it's pulling apart. And where they're pushing together, you get huge earthquakes, mountain belts like the Himalayas and such like, and the rings of volcanoes right around the Pacific Ocean, the famous Ring of Fire. So that change happened just as I came into the subject, and that was really a very exciting time. So a lot of things have changed over the past decades that I've been involved in it, and it's been very exciting. And I've been fortunate to be in a place where a lot of the big steps forward were taken, you know, conceptually, and where there were good resources to go and do field work. So yes, things have changed, and I think we're getting pretty good at predicting where volcanoes are going to erupt now. And really not many people die in volcanic eruptions, and actually I think a lot of the people that die are volcanologists who, you know, when an eruption starts, they run towards it while everybody else runs away. Yeah, so things have changed, and I think that volcanoes are one area where we do understand pretty well what's happening. We understand the warning signs, and we can take steps to move people out of danger.
And my understanding is that plate tectonics, as far as we know, is very unusual across the universe, or across known habitable planets and so on. Is that right, that there's something unique about the Earth, which means that it's that plate tectonics is a very important factor?
Yes. Actually, we don't know any other habitable planets at the moment.
Sure.
There might be some that were. But you're right, it's the dynamic Earth, the fact it's always moving, which makes it a habitable place. And in fact, you know, the Earth has been through a few phases many hundreds of millions of years ago where it was completely frozen. And life as we know it could not exist on an Earth that's completely frozen. They even have a name for it, call it Snowball Earth. But what got us out of that was volcanoes, which brought lots of carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, which then warmed it up and the ice melted and we got back to normal. But I think the most amazing thing about Earth actually is that the temperature throughout its whole history of about 4,500 million years has remained between 0 degrees and 100 degrees. And that's when water stays liquid, of course. If it got hotter, the water would boil off and that would be the end of life as we know it. If it got colder, it would be frozen, like I was just saying, and it'd be very difficult for life to exist in the form we know it. So there seem to be really strong feedback mechanisms which are holding the Earth just in that sweet zone where life can exist. And that's pretty unusual. I'm not saying there's not other places in the universe where it happens, but we don't know of any at the moment. So it is very special. And you know, you can look at that from a Christian perspective as saying, well, I'm not surprised, you know, that God's made a universe which is fit for life, and that Earth is one of those special places. Or you can just say it's random. I know which I prefer, but it is a very special place. And it's a dynamic Earth moving around which enables that to be the case, actually, as well as life, which gives the feedback, which maintains the temperature so stable. It's a dynamic Earth which pushes up mountain belts, and then the mountains get eroded down and the soil is deposited by rivers in the valleys, and that's where we grow our crops. So you need the mountain belts to grow your crops in a way. It's mountain belts that trigger the rainfall from monsoons in some places, rain in others. So these things which can be hazardous to life are also what makes the Earth a fertile place. The volcanoes, the earthquakes, the floods and so on are what makes it habitable. So it's an interesting thing that we have to navigate our way to live in a hazardous world in a way which enables those hazards not to be dangerous. And I have to say that actually people in the past could do it a lot better than people now. You know, when you live close to the Earth, you saw the signs. Actually, I think Jesus said something about that, didn't he? He said, you can understand the signs of the, you know, red sky at night, shepherd's delight, red sky in morning, shepherd's warning, that sort of folklore, which works pretty well. But Jesus said, you're not very good at recognizing spiritual signs. Yeah, we live in a fertile world, which is hazardous. That's the way God's made it for us to live here. And if we live in it in the way God intends us to, then it works out okay. If we don't, you know, and we live in cities, we kind of divorce ourselves from the world around, the natural world around us, then that's when things get dangerous.
It's interesting because, I mean, I'm sure as you, I mean, you know, you've written about this, natural disasters, things like earthquakes and volcanoes, some people point to those and say, well, hold on, how can we believe in a good God creating a good earth when it is so dangerous, so violent, so destructive? What's your kind of general understanding of how we as Christians can reconcile the fact that God created a good world and yet it is so deadly to us so often?
It's hazardous, for sure. You know, it's a place that we have to navigate and live in relationship with. But there's sort of, there's three poles, really. God, the creator, created the earth and he created humans, and he created humans to be in relationship with him as God, but also in relationship with the creation he made. And things go wrong when our relationship with God is broken vertically, but also when our relationship with the natural world we live in is broken. And that's when things go wrong. But as I say, if it wasn't for volcanoes, earthquakes and such like, and floods particularly, it would be a sterile world. And so he's made a world which we can live in if we live in it in the way he intended. And I don't think he ever intended the world to be sort of a holiday camp where we just lay back and sunbathe on the beach all day, which personally I find really boring, actually. I can't imagine why people like doing that, actually. But he didn't make a world like that. He made a world that we had to work in, you know. I mean, the very first command he gave in Genesis 1:28 was to have dominion over the world, actually, quite a strong word. Which involves stewardship, but it's actually a bit more stronger than stewardship alone, isn't it? Having dominion over the world, keeping the world in order, you know, making sure crops grow and they're not overwhelmed by weeds and such like, making sure the animals are secure and safe and you keep the lions away from the lambs. And this is all part of living in God's world in God's way. All those things are important in that. And what's gone wrong, I think, is that people have, I think it's selfishness, which is another word for sinfulness, really, putting yourself first. And we've said, look, God, I don't want to live in your world in your way. I want to live in my world my way. You know, I want to put myself first. Not your will be done, but my will be done, is what we've said. And that's when things go wrong. And it's so easy to track that in our present day, isn't it? You know, global climate change from all the greenhouse gases we're pumping in. We know full well what we're doing, but we'd rather carry on doing it because we rather like our lifestyles or building houses on floodplains. And then we complain when the floods come and they fall down. You know, they're quite basic things which at root are putting ourselves at the centre of things instead of looking after God's world in the way he actually commanded us to do it on his behalf. So I think that's my answer to saying it is a beautiful world. And, you know, we see glimpses of it, don't we, from time to time. But it's a world which we have to work in to keep it in order as God wants. And as far as I can tell, that's going to be the case in the new creation as well. You know, we're going to have jobs to do and look after. And actually, people are healthier and better, have better mental health when you have jobs to do, which are rewarding and doing things for other people. So I think it's intriguing that we're in such a world, but that's the way God made it to be. And, you know, that's fine by me. That's what he did.
It is interesting, isn't it? In the history of Western thought, it's often said that this massive earthquake that happened in Lisbon was a turning point which led many thinkers and philosophers to say, you know, because of the loss of life in Lisbon, therefore the old view of a God of immense care and providence over his creation was no longer tenable. And yet I remember when I first heard you speaking along these lines, being struck by that and how your understanding and vision is really very different, and that so much of it is due to so much of the loss of life and so much of the so-called natural disasters are actually due to human failure and lack of use of the knowledge that we already have.
Yes, I think earthquakes are a tricky thing because you can't predict them, but we do know where they happen, and so we can build things so that they don't fall down. Nowadays we can. I mean, we can talk about Lisbon in a minute. But there were two very famous earthquakes, which I often reflect on. In California in 1989, there was an earthquake which killed 57 people, and they were mostly killed on a two-story freeway where the top story pancaked onto the bottom story and killed people there. But they were in process of reinforcing that, and they hadn't got to that section. They'd reinforced some other section. So this was a magnitude 7 earthquake, 10 kilometers depth, strike slip earthquake technically, and 57 people died. That was in 1989. In 2010, some of us will remember there was an earthquake in Haiti, 12th of January 2010, and it was an identical earthquake, magnitude 7, strike slip fault, 10 kilometers depth. And instead of 57 people dying, 230,000 people died. You know, 250,000 people died. And it was due to poor construction. You know, Haiti was one of the poorest nations in the Northern Hemisphere. And people were living on shanty towns, on landslides, on slopes, which then landslided down in the earthquake. And so they were squashed. And there'd been endemic corruption in Haiti with Papa Doc Duvalier and his son, Baby Doc Duvalier, for years and years. The French had been extracting interest payments from them because the slaves had had the temerity to take back their own land in Haiti. And so, you know, whose fault is it that 250,000 people died there? Well, it was human corruption, because there's an identical earthquake, actually 20 years later than the previous one, and people died. It wasn't the fault of the people who died either. It was the fault of, you know, this endemic structure that they were living in. And there was a very striking picture I sometimes use in Haiti, where there were two buildings in the same street. One was a 13-story digital communication building built by one of the main mobile phone networks in the Caribbean. Plate glass windows all around, and nothing fell down there. Some of the, not even the plate glass windows were cracked because it had earthquake resistant structures within it. Just down the road was a 3-story hospital built in the same year, brand new building, built in 2009, just a year before the earthquake. And that pancaked and killed many, many people. And they had building codes for the same building codes for both buildings, but endemic corruption meant they'd ignore them in building the hospital. So whose fault is that again? So even in earthquakes, there's often human factors at play there, as you said, and that's very striking. And at root cause, it's human sinfulness, to be honest, just to put it, you know, to call a spade a spade. Mm-hmm. Human selfishness. You know, if you ignore building codes and you don't use enough cement, you don't put reinforcing bars in where you ought to save money, then that's a consequence at the end of the day. And you can trace the same sort of thing to many, many different disasters that happen. And globally at the moment, you know, climate change is causing more intense floods, more intense heat waves. People are dying, even in Europe, from heat waves nowadays. And whose fault is that? Well, we know about climate change. You know, it's our fault, isn't it, that we're pumping greenhouse gases in against all common sense, really. So... yeah, it's a sad reflection of the world, but it is the way the world is. And I think it's the one place where the gospel has something concrete to say. And if I just go back to Haiti, we did some research after that earthquake, looking at people who had lost family members, lost their livelihoods, lost their homes. And the thing that was so striking that came out of it was that the people that had some faith before the earthquake, maybe Christians, terrible events in the earthquake, they lost family members, things that it's really hard to imagine happening, actually came out of it still believing in God. You know, our interviewer asked them, you know, why do you? And I think the reason is they had some explanatory framework. There was a God who was loving and good, and they didn't understand why, but nevertheless they trusted that he knew why this had happened. Whereas the people who fell apart were those who didn't have any particular faith, and they had no explanatory framework. They'd had this disaster happen and they just fell apart. So it's actually the opposite of what people often say. You know, your belief in a good God will fall apart in this earthquake or this disaster. You'll have no way of coping. And the opposite seems to be true. And at least from my experience, and you know, you've been a doctor, you probably know this better than me. Even, you know, at small level, individual level, people with faith before some disaster often come out of it with often with enhanced faith, actually. They don't understand why, but they just trust that God knows why. And so they've got something to hold on to. And I think that's very striking. So in the Lisbon case, I don't know, you know, it's often used as a trigger for the for humanism and so on. But I don't think that is actually the case, because, you know, reality doesn't hold out with that real people with real faith respond in the way I've just described to disasters. And I take that actually as a measure of a good God who does care about us, that he enables us to respond in that way.
It's interesting to, I mean, it's very striking the comparison you draw between the death toll in Haiti and in California. And you, I think it's hard to dispute the idea that you're right, that today earthquakes act as a kind of harsh, unsparing light on human sinfulness and our failures to do what we must do to look after our fellow citizens, corruption and poverty and injustice and those systemic sins. But in a time gone by, when we had no understanding of plate tectonics, let alone reinforced concrete, and no understanding of how to build deep foundations, earthquakes were seen as a kind of act of God, was often the phrase used. You know, this is kind of out of the bolt from the blue. Suddenly the ground starts to move and all your buildings fall down and many are killed. And it's hard to see, it's harder to understand in those sense, what have people done wrong? You know, to use the Lisbon example, what have they done wrong there? Was this a reflection of their sinfulness, or was this just bad luck that they happened to have built a city before the era of reinforced concrete right on a geological fault?
Yeah, well, let me just take you back one step, actually, which is that another photograph I've often used is from Istanbul, Turkey, where there was a big earthquake. And there's a number of examples. There were some tall tower blocks of flats and so on, which fell down, again, because building codes had not been followed. People were putting, the builders were putting barrels, empty oil barrels in the walls to save them pouring concrete, you know. But actually, there's a very striking picture of several of these all pancaked down. In the middle is a 100-foot-high prayer minaret, which is still standing, right? 100 years old, more than 100 years old, actually, and 100 foot high, I think it was. Because it was built in a way which just flexed with the earthquake. And I've got another photo of a local indigenous house which had cross beams of wood with just brick in between, and it all distorted. The fault ran right through it. There's a fracture in the ground running right through it, and the door had got distorted and it didn't quite open anymore, but it didn't fall down. So actually, I think people did know when they lived close to the land, they knew how to build things. They knew the ground often shook, and so they built things in ways which, you know, distorted but didn't kill them. So often it was the case that they weren't so deadly. People lived more rural lives, more dispersed, so it wasn't so dangerous as concentrated cities. And in the case of Lisbon, I mean, the earthquake was quite a long way away from Lisbon, actually. It was just shaken. It wasn't, the faults didn't actually go through Lisbon. But there were houses built very close together, very tall wooden houses, a bit like the Great Fire of London. And it was, I think, a Sunday morning when it happened. And people were baking, and these houses caught fire, and there was a firestorm. And that's what killed most of the people. It wasn't actually the houses falling down. And then people ran to the coast, and this was bad luck, really. There was then a tsunami a couple of hours later, and a lot of them drowned in the tsunami. So, yeah, people do die. I'm not saying every single death could have been avoided if they'd been more sensible, or, you know, they prayed more or whatever. But in that case, you can again trace it to human factors, although maybe you can't really blame them for building buildings close together and for having fires in wooden buildings and so on, because that's what people did. But that was a consequence in that case.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because there's an incident in the Gospels about the Tower of Siloam, wasn't it, that fell down, and that was obviously an issue in the news at the time, and Jesus refers to it and says, was it because of their sin? And the answer is no. But he uses that as an example to warn people of a coming judgment. So, I mean, it's a phrase that I've often used in my own reflecting about this, about medical and biological suffering, that suffering is a mystery. Mm. It isn't something that we can just solve as an intellectual problem. Mm. And it isn't primarily a practical, pragmatic issue. Suffering is a mystery which demands a presence. And I'm sure that's true about natural disasters, isn't it? There's an element of that which is utterly inexplicable. Mm. But we're called to be there. And it's interesting, isn't it, that wherever there is a natural disasters across the world, it is also true that you do see these remarkable human responses of compassion and resilience and sometimes courage and sacrifice, that disasters bring the best out of fallen human beings. I mean, it's a weird and strange reality, but we've seen that so many times.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with you. That case in the Tower of Siloam, I think 13 people were killed. It wasn't Jesus that was asking why people are killed. It was the locals were coming to Jesus and saying, were those people more sinful than others, or were their fathers more sinful? And that's when Jesus said, no, they weren't more sinful. And he turned them around 180 degrees and said, unless you repent, you too will die. As we all know, we're all going to die. So you're exactly right about that. But interestingly, just a few verses before that, he also talks about a case where they came to him, where a lot of people had been murdered in effectively the state had shot people they thought were terrorists. This is a very contemporary, actually, example. And he said, you know, those people who died at the hands of some military, were they more sinful? And Jesus gave exactly the same answer. So human killing and dying in a disaster, he gave the same answer, unless you repent, you too will die. So pointing to that deeper important truth, actually. And you're quite right about suffering. We don't know what it is, except Jesus said it, you know, in many ways you do grow under suffering more than you grow when you're sitting in an armchair and sort of cushions with no... So even there you can see God's hand in it, I think. And, you know, one of the oldest books in the Bible of Job, you know, do you remember Job's friend when Job lost everything, basically all of his wealth, his very wealthy man, all his family members and so on. And his so-called friends kept saying, you know, there must be something you've not repented of, some sin. This simple equation, you know, you're bad, therefore, you know, God's punished you. And he said, no, I haven't. I just want God to explain himself. And I think that is often the way, isn't it? You say, in the midst of some disaster, why me, oh Lord, you know, why has it happened to me? What have I done? And eventually, when Job gets his day in court with God, if you like, and God does start speaking to him out of the storm cloud, God doesn't give an answer. He doesn't give a logical answer because of A, then B happened. He just points to his great creative ability. You know, look at the stars I've made. Look at this, look at that. Even all the amazing creativity I've shown. And it's quite a funny speech by God, actually, because he says to Job, were you there when I laid the foundations of the earth? You know, tell me if you have understanding. You know, do you know better than me how it was made and why it was made? And God even refers to the most terrible beast you can imagine, the Leviathan, you know, which actually nobody can touch. And yet God says, you know, would you play with him as a bird? Would you put him on a leash for your little girls to play with? No human is so fierce that he dares to stir him up, but me, I God, who can stand before me? Because, you know, I can tame him completely. And Job's answer is, basically, you're God and I'm not, you know. I know you can do all things, no purpose of yours can be thwarted. So I uttered why I didn't understand, said Job, things too wonderful for me which I did not know. So you're quite right, we don't know the answer to these things. And Job came to that realization when he just saw God's power in the universe, his sovereign power, creativity and so on, over everything, over evil as well as over good things. And it's a hard lesson to learn, isn't it? But it's a hard lesson to learn, but you've seen suffering and you've seen people come out of it immensely. I mean, in ways I can hardly imagine, just accepting God's love for them.
Have you ever wrestled with tough questions about faith? Or maybe you've had a friend who's skeptical about Christianity. That's exactly why we want to send you a powerful resource that I believe needs to be in the hands of every believer. Justin Brierley's book, Unbelievable, Why, After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian. In this book, Justin reflects on 10 years of conversations with atheists, skeptics, and believers alike, and explains why he still finds Christianity the most compelling explanation for life, the universe, and everything in between. I know this book will strengthen your faith and equip you for meaningful conversations. And for a limited time, this book is our special thanks to you for your gift to Premier Insight. Your support ensures content like this and other shows and programs are available to bring faith-filled conversations to a world that needs them. So I encourage you to give today by going to premierinsight.org/C.S. Lewis. That's premierinsight.org/C.S. Lewis to receive your book today. Now on to today's show.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Yeah, I was just reflecting on another parable that Jesus said of the wise man and the foolish man, which we all sang at Sunday school. The wise man built his house upon the rock. But interestingly, because the point is that the storm is going to come, Jesus says the storm. In other words, it's almost like the storm is inevitable. Mm. In all our lives, there are going to be inexplicable storms and challenges. And Jesus, again, doesn't really explain why the storm comes, but the test is whether your house is built on the rock or built on the sand. The storm is taken almost as an inevitability.
That's true. And actually, I think it's encouraging that the Bible is realistic about these things. You know, it doesn't say life's going to be a bed of roses. It says it's, you know, there's tough choices to make, tough things to do. But, you know, there is a saviour at the end of it. So you're right. And that's what I like about the Bible. It is very realistic about, you know, people's failings and so on, and how God deals with them, and that there is a way through it.
There's another point about this, and that is that I understand that it was that for sort of 1600 years of Christian history and beyond, the existence of suffering had never been seen as an argument against God's reality. Mm. And it's only with the Enlightenment and beyond that this now becomes what for many people is the knockdown argument against the existence of God. You know, I can't believe in God in a world of such suffering. What's so fascinating to me is that that is a new argument in the history of thought. That is not something that you find in the scriptures. People challenged, why me? You know, why God? Why don't you do this? Why don't you smite them? But they never questioned his existence or his goodness.
Yeah, no, you're right about that. And I think maybe it's because we have lives which are too cushioned from reality in some ways. You know, I was very struck that the people rarely talk about a relative dying. They don't say he died. They say he passed away or he's moved on or is and so on. And I, you know, I didn't see a dead body until I saw my mother you know, when I was in my 50s, I went to see my mother's body when before she was buried. And we're sort of isolated from it in a way, which in the past they wouldn't, because life and death would happen in your house. You know, granny would die because she was old and you'd bury her, and, you know, and animals were born and died and so on. And you were sort of immersed in that life and death. And now we kind of think we can banish death just by ignoring it. We can banish suffering by ignoring it. And it's evidently not true. And the striking thing to me is the strength of people who have suffered, who are Christian believers, and the example of how they've come through that. And I think that's a real encouragement, actually. And I think we should, you know, be really grateful to people who have suffered and show us how they can still know God's love and actually be, of course, full of grief and so on, but still have a purpose in life and an acceptance of God's love for them and his sovereignty over them, which, as I said before, as a medic, you've lived much closer to than I have, of course, in your daily life almost.
It's true. And going back historically, the thing which really strikes me is it's the death of children, you know, that it's not really until the Second World War, or certainly, you know, the earlier years of the 20th century, that childhood mortality really came down. I mean, before then, every family would have watched children die virtually, and they would have died in their home. And it was just a terrible, tragic reality of everyday life.
Yeah.
And of course, women died in childbirth, massive mortality, as we can even see in the scriptures. Yeah. So I'm sure you're right. We are massively insulated because of the advances in medicine, so much of which has come from a science and from a Christian understanding of the intelligibility of the universe and so on, has now meant that we've become inured and relatively soft. And that has led many people, paradoxically, to say, well, I can't believe in God.
Yes, indeed. I mean, we shouldn't forget that Jesus said death is the last great enemy. I mean, death is a terrible thing. I mean, but the terrible thing is dying out of relationship with God. That is what the Bible sees as the most awful thing that can happen to you. Dying in relationship with God is tough, but you know, there is a new creation coming. So that's a different matter. So we shouldn't make light of death. Of course we shouldn't, because it is a great enemy. But there is an answer to it in Jesus, in his life, death and resurrection. And, you know, of all things, I think it's the fact that Jesus rose again, which actually gives the proof of that new creation. Actually, if it wasn't for that, then, yeah, it might just be a fairy tale, mightn't it? But it's for real. So I wish we'd talk more about death, actually. And I think our children are really good about talking to their children about things dying. One of the good things with children is we always had hamsters at home. You know, hamsters only live about 2 years. So, you know, you're going to see life and death with hamsters. And actually, I think that's really good for children to go through that and to grieve and to see and, you know, to see hamsters will carry on afterwards. And
do you remember my hamster dad dying in the 1990s? And I remember you encouraged me to bury it in the garden with a little wooden cross over its kind of tiny grave, and we could talk about, you know, death and what it means and our hope as Christians in life beyond death. I mean it stuck with me 20 years later, clearly, that it did leave an impact.
I'm not theologically whether, you know, whether the cross, did Jesus die for hamsters? Now, here's an interesting theological problem.
Ambiguous one, yeah.
You know, no, I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, we've gone slightly off topic, but it's a very important and an interesting area. In my, tragically, in my work, I was very often dealing with babies who were dying and parents who were desperately trying to get their heads around this and grieving and so on. And traditionally, the view was that you should try to protect children from this, you know, that you try and pretend it wasn't happening and, you know, children shouldn't be there and so on. But all the evidence suggested that actually involving children, siblings and so on, in the death of the baby was actually very positive, not just for the children, but actually for the adults, that the presence of children with appropriate emotional support and explanation actually helped them and helped the parents process what was happening. And often children look back to those memories of being able to be there when the baby was dying, and maybe to wash the baby after death, and select clothes, all those kind of things, which you would think would be deeply, deeply traumatizing. Actually, with the right kind of support, it became a very positive thing. So I think we do live in a kind of death-denying culture, and that brings with it quite a lot of bad things, of being out of touch with the painful. So yes, death is an enemy, but it's also something, as you say, Bob, that Jesus has defeated in the resurrection.
What, just to circle back round briefly to that question of theodicy, kind of the philosophical arguments about how do we explain suffering and pain in a world created by a good God. I remember when I was a student, and I was a history student, not a science student, but when I was kind of thinking these things through, the kind of classic example you would be taught, the classic kind of Christian response to that accusation that how can God exist in a world of suffering is, well, that God created a good world, but then when human beings rebelled in our sinfulness, it doesn't just have negative consequences for us and our relationships with each other. It doesn't just cut us off from our relationship with God, but it kind of fractures and corrupts and perverts created order itself. And that, we might say that things like earthquakes and volcanoes will exist because they have kind of good consequences as well as challenging, harmful ones. But something like cancer or children dying of preventable diseases in mortality, that clearly can't exist in God's perfect new creation. They are the consequence of human sinfulness that is now flowing out of humans and into the fabric of creation itself. But I also am aware that some Christians dispute that and say, hang on, that natural world as God created it remains good, and evil only exists within humans. I wonder if you had a view on that particular thinking or that line of debate.
Well, it's clear that creation is groaning, because Paul says that, because of what humans have done, and it's longing for the return of Jesus and the new creation. And so we are intrinsically bound up, and you know, nature is what God does. We sometimes talk about it as if nature's something different from God, but it's not. He's immanent in the world as well. I mean, that's been understood for millennia, actually. I think Tertullian first said it, didn't he, that nature is what God does. So we have to be a little bit careful. You can't just say, well, that's nature and not God. We're embedded in that. But I must admit, I don't know what to say about cancer, except that, you know, we're getting better at dealing with it, which, you know, I think part of God's goodness is that he's given us a world which is understandable by humans, you know, that we can do science. There's no a priori reason that should be the case, but we can, and he wants us to do science to use it for the good of humankind. You know, and the medical advances we've had, which are tremendous in my lifetime, you know, I think a consequence of God's good creation. So, you know, going forward, then, yeah, I can't really know what to say about cancer, because, you know, growth of cells is something which is good, but it's gone awry there. But everything looks as if we're going to be able, you know, within decades even, to deal with a lot of cancerous growth. Well, we already can, can't we, with some things, with stem cell treatments and so on. So, and it's a horrible thing, but I think going forwards, there are ways of dealing with it, which are a consequence of living in an ordered world, which God has given us to live in. I mean, the worries then about medical treatment, which you must think about a lot as a medic, that, you know, the rich can afford it, and again it's the poor and the underprivileged who suffer, which is just a perpetual story of the human condition, isn't it?
Tragically, yeah, it is. And it's Again, I think there's mystery here. For me, as a paediatrician, the most painful thing to try to get your head around are genetic, abnormalities. It so happens that Tim's daughter, is impacted by a genetic disease, an abnormality which just happened, a sort of chance, spontaneous mutation, which has, had lifelong consequences for her. And, trying to understand, why does that happen? How do you understand? Of course, genetic mutation seems to be absolutely essential to the whole process of evolution and of life growing and changing and developing. So there's deep mystery, isn't there, in the way to try to understand this. And I think we come back to Job, that we're not going to find some neat theological solutions.
I mean, you're right. The mutations are essential for evolution to work. None of us would be here if genes didn't spontaneously mutate all the time. And yet the vast majority of those mutations, as far as we can tell, either have no effect at all or cause things that are of no advantage, such as, our daughter's eye condition. And I, having fully met, not an expert and not put massive thought into it, I find it hard to believe that God's original good order of creation involved every living thing running the risk every time it procreated of a suite of genetic mutations, most of which would just cause needless harm, unnecessary suffering. That feels much more easily explicable if that is a consequence of that groaning of creation, the way that, our decisions to sin and rebel against God have fractured his good creation in ways that cause suffering, but will ultimately be resolved by the eschaton. Similar with cancer, of course, cells need to grow, but why did it have to be the case that it's that every cell has the possibility of engaging this kind of runaway growth, which only ever causes harm, never causes any benefit, causes enormous suffering for all forms of life? I find it hard to see how that could be, quote unquote, the best of all possible worlds, to use that famous kind of theodicy in the kind of Enlightenment era, that this is, even with its existence of evil, this is that the only way God could have made the world. It feels like these things surely can be traced back to human sinfulness, even if it's the mechanism about how our sin can cause cancer or genetic mutations is somewhat spiritually mysterious.
Yes, we don't understand it, but I would just push back a bit. As a geologist, you can see dinosaurs with arthritis and other diseases. Actually, we know they existed before humans ever existed on Earth, unless you have some complicated scheme of our sinfulness going backwards in time, or angels falling or something. It just seems to be part of life, actually. And maybe it's because, it does give humans the chance to show that care and that love and that empathy for their weaker offspring or brethren or so on, which is so striking, actually. And I think John mentioned, the fact of the best of human nature coming out after disasters. Well, it also comes out, doesn't it, in the grown child that gives up their career to care for their ailing parent. There's something self-sacrificial about that, which is modeling Jesus in many ways, his sacrifice for us. So who's to say that, that human sacrifice on behalf of somebody else who's suffering is a bad thing? Maybe these people, I don't know how to put it in a theologically proper way, but they're closer to God than I am, because they're suffering this and they're responding to God in a way which is deeper than I ever have the opportunity to do, because I've not had to face that sort of suffering. So there is mystery here. And Paul made clear that, not all suffering was a disaster. You know, I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us, he said. And so, you know, I can cling on to that without understanding why it should be the case that we live in a world like this. But, you know, going right back to the beginning, God didn't make us a place to live, which is a holiday camp. And I can quite see why that wouldn't be much fun. I wouldn't like to live in a holiday camp all my life. He made a place where we have to work. We have to respond to him, you know, try and live in this world in the way that Jesus himself would live in, which showed immense empathy and care for the poor, the suffering, the underdogs, as we all know. And so I can cling on to that really as the way to live in this world. And, you know, Jesus said that we will bit by bit become more like him. Well, it's very bit by bit in my case, and not very far along that route, but that is what he offered us. And in the new creation, we will be fully the people he intended us to be. You know, he made us to be, and that's something to be thankful for, actually, to hold on to, not to put life on hold until then, but at least, you know, there is a final destination where we will be the people he meant us to be in all the richness of that.
Bob, can I just circle around then? And I very much agree with what you're saying, and trying to live in this tension between, you know, knowing what we do know and being grateful for it, and yet recognizing there are other areas of mystery which we can't penetrate. Could I circle around before we finish to the issue of climate change? Some time ago, many months ago, we did a podcast looking at attitudes to climate change amongst young people, and we were both really quite struck, and if not horrified, by the amount of climate doom there is amongst young people, with huge percentages saying, you know, the planet is completely doomed, there's nothing that can be done, you know, we're probably going to be wiped out in our generation, etc., etc., etc. And we tried to push back a bit about that and quoted some of the science and you know, that actually there was evidence. Yes, there was a huge problem with greenhouse gases, but there's also evidence of remarkable changes taking place. And therefore, there was no place for this utter sort of doom. But interestingly, we then had a bit of pushback on our podcast saying that we were minimizing the risks and so on. So I'd be interested in your take. You're someone who's eminently qualified this. What's your take about the balance between recognizing that climate change is real, that anthropogenic greenhouse gases and so on are contributing this, versus the kind of doom, climate doom, which actually seems to be remarkably common amongst young people?
Yes. Well, that's a big question, isn't it? I mean, I think one answer to this is that those of us that have caused climate change, which is the rich nations, the high income nations, Europe, North America, mostly, who have benefited from, you know, cheap fossil fuels that have got us to where we are now, ought to be playing our part in helping people to cope with the changes in the low income parts of the world, the majority world, who will suffer the consequences. Mainly, we won't suffer the consequences. If crops fail, we just buy them from somewhere else. But, you know, if you live a subsistence farmer in sub-Saharan Africa, it really matters if the crops fail for 2 or 3 years and people are already dying from that. So there is a real place where we can play a part from our riches in helping people to adapt to the changes. So the problem with the changes is that they're happening so fast, I think, that people can't adapt to them, right? So if the world gets a little bit drier, then you can change your agriculture eventually. If you live in a place where it's going to get drier or a place where it's going to get wetter, you can adapt to it over time. But it's happening so quickly that people can't adapt. It's also happening in a way, you know, if you live in Bangladesh, where 30 million people live within a meter of sea level, and it's a delta, so you can't build a wall around it to keep the sea out, so you need to move somewhere a bit higher. But we live in nation states with huge barriers around our borders. And so there is a case for, you know, taking more care of refugees who have to move because of consequences of climate change that we've done. So there are positive things that can be done. And I don't think doom is the right answer, but we should both try and prevent further damage. So trying to reduce our use of fossil fuels, which we can do. I mean, it's actually cheaper to get power from wind and solar than it is from burning oil at the moment. It's just easier to burn oil in some ways. So we can try and reduce our use of fossil fuels, but we can also help people to adapt to the changes which we know are happening. You know, whether it's because the climate's changed, so we help them find irrigation methods and crops that will survive, different from what they've been used to in the past. We help them build houses which will survive. We help, you know, take care that they have protection from floods and extreme rainfall and so on. So there are things we can do. But whether the will to do it is there is the question. And it again comes down to the selfishness of us and what we do with our resources. And I often reflect on the fact that, you know, in the new creation, we'll be held to account in a way for what we've done with what we've been given. And we have been given in Britain or North America huge, huge resources of finance and so on. Are we using that wisely and well to help those who don't have those resources? And I fear that's where the problem is, more than the doom from the world at large. And it comes right back again to a Christian perspective on what we do with our wealth and what we've been given, doesn't it? And, you know, the Bible has a lot to say about that, which is hard, actually, to be honest. But I would say that's the answer, actually. And it saddens me that, you know, our government and other governments have moved away from our overseas aid. You know, just we pledged 50 years ago, I think it was, or 40 years ago, to give 0.7% of our GDP to overseas aid, a trivial amount, which we finally did reach along with only half a dozen other nations, although many, many pledged to do it. But we've retreated even from that, saying we've got to look after ourselves first. Now, putting our own interests first above those of others seems to me a definition of sin, actually, definition of selfishness, certainly. And so I think that the problem is right at the heart of the human condition again. So I wouldn't be totally despondent, but I would say to young people, you know, get stuck in. There are things that can be done about it, both in helping create ways for those that are suffering the consequences to deal with them, but also in lobbying our government, getting into these areas where we can change the thinking and the policy on these things. That's, you might say that's a bit wishy-washy, but there are ways forward. And young people are much more idealistic than us ancient cynical people. Well, I hope I'm not cynical, but, you know, as you get old, you do get a bit, I've seen this before kind of thing. And they are idealistic and then get in there and do things. And some of them are doing that things. And, you know, in my own area of earth sciences, you know, a lot of people where 30 years ago they would have gone into oil industry are now going into environmental companies, into government, a lot of them going into government policy making and so on. And I think that's great, actually, because this is actually the way we get forward, particularly in a democracy. You know, we can change things if we really want to. Not a total answer, but I think there are positive things that can be done, and we should encourage young people to get into those things to do them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks.
Just lastly then, before we wrap up, you've, alongside your kind of scientific career, you've also had a long interest in the kind of interface with Christianity and with faith and science. I know you led the Faraday Institute for some time, you've written books. Do you ever come across pushback from scientific colleagues who can't quite believe that a serious scientist with credibility is actually also a believer in a supernatural God and does really think Jesus rose from the dead? Does that still happen where people just think, how can you marry the two together?
I don't think they don't really worry about the intellectual aspect of it. They just think I'm a bit daft to waste my time on some stuff like that, on mythical, what they think might be mythical stuff. But I think they respect it. That's what I do. They have different, they would see it as different hobbies, you know, they play hockey or something. They play in an orchestra or whatever, and I have my hobby, and that's okay, as long as it doesn't interfere with my work. But there is a deeper a deeper question. I mean, I do get the opportunity to talk about these things more seriously with people sometimes. I do field work with students. We're out in the middle of nowhere for days on end, you know, we're driving for hours on end. So occasionally, you know, these conversations come up and you can talk about it then. But I think as long as you do your job well, it's okay. I think if I started not doing my job well, I'm retired now, but if I wasn't doing my job well because I was going off doing some Christian thing, that would quite properly, I think they would complain about that. So, but I think it's good that people should be, you know, good at their professions, whatever they are, whether a musician or an artist or a builder or a car mechanic or a scientist, you know, do that really well. And then you can get, people can listen to you then. And if you want to talk about your faith, then you have some solid ground to talk about it on. So that's always been my perspective, really, that to do my science as well as I can.
And I suppose from your perspective, it's not a hobby like hockey, is it? There is a clear, tangible connection between, I won't speak for you, the reason you're interested in earth sciences and geophysics is in part because you do believe that we live in a world of order created by a creator God. And that famous saying goes, you know, but as the more you study, you're kind of thinking God's thoughts after him.
Yeah, though, actually, that's not why I do it day to day. I do it because I'm just a child at heart, you know, I'm just curious. You know, every child says, why? I'm sure your children say, why, you know, why does this happen? Why does that happen? So it's just fun, actually. It's a fine act, actually. I mean, it is a bit different from being a medic where you have a specific goal to to help people get better or survive or whatever. You know, I'm just interested in how things work. But you're right, it is God's creation. So, you know, I feel this is great that I can do it. And actually, it's very interesting. When you become a staff member at Cambridge, you have to sign a pledge to uphold the university as a place of education, religion, research and teaching. Religion is right there as one of them. I don't know if it is in UCL where John was, but every college...
It certainly isn't, though.
Well, actually, if you look at the Cambridge University website, it's omitted. It says our mission statement is education, teaching and research or something, education, learning and research. But it's still in what we have to sign that religion is part of it. And so, you know, I've been very happy doing my job and talking about religious things because I signed up to do that. and I'm glad that's the case. But I've never felt any tension between my faith, my religious beliefs and my science. You know, they've always just been fine. I've never felt they're in conflict, actually. And why should they be, you know, if I'm studying God's creation? So I think it's almost an art. It's like some of the things we talked about earlier. It's only in the last 100, 150 years or something that people have ever thought was a conflict. You know, they just naturally assumed that, you know, this world was created by God and we live in it and we've got to make the best fist of it we can. So it's quite a recent thing, the thought that they might be in conflict. But indeed, you mentioned the Faraday Institute for Science and Faith, and partly we founded that just to show our scientific colleagues you don't have to throw your brain away to be a person of faith as well, that, you know, actually faith and science together give a much richer view of the world we live in than either on their own. Bit sterile if it's just science. It's a bit disconnected from reality if you're just going to be super spiritual, you know. So they go together well, I think, actually. And it's interesting that if you speak to young people particularly, but also scientists generally, they'll often say they're very spiritual, even though they don't really know what they believe in. And they won't say they're Christian or any follower of any religion, but they say they're spiritual. That's intriguing, isn't it? That God has somehow put inside us a yearning to know him, actually, which I take as spiritual. And there is an answer. And I think it's the great thing about the Christian faith is that any Christian believer of whatever stripe or wherever, whatever standing, you know, they can portray Jesus to people. And there is a yearning in people to hear that. And so I think my prayer often is just to open, that God will open people's eyes to see the truth that's there. So I think, you know, I'm encouraged by that, actually, that that even in young people, even in scientists, there's a yearning for spiritual awareness, which we should be thankful for, actually, as Christian believers. It's just waiting to be fanned into fire.
Absolutely. Well, that seems like a good place to draw a line. Thanks so much, Bob. It's been really fascinating talking to you and hearing some of your thoughts on these big chunky questions about science and faith and suffering and all of that stuff. So thanks so much for coming on the show. I hope listeners enjoyed hearing some of that as well. If people want to find out some more, have you got a website or a book or other resources you might point listeners to if they want to kind of go further in any of the stuff we've been talking about?
Well, I think they should Google Faraday Institute. There is an institution which builds batteries, Faraday Institution in Britain. You don't want that one, but you want the Faraday Institute for Science and Faith. And there's huge resources there. There's lots of talks you can listen to and download for free. I think there's 1,000 of them, and there's been millions of downloads of those from all sorts of experts. I think you'll even find your dad in there, Tim.
I wouldn't waste your time on those talks. I would
not say that thank you, in Sam. The slightest. you'll find lots of people. And you also, actually, if you look at Faraday papers, these are, I think, one of the most useful things, actually. They're four sides of A4. They're just very short papers on all sorts of topics, from some of these big questions about suffering and genetics and evolution and the age of the Earth and all kinds of things from experts in the field who are Christians. And you can read them over breakfast. Actually, you can't read them over breakfast in my household, because the one thing when we got married, my wife said, is... you are absolutely not to read over breakfast when I'm having breakfast with you. We're going to talk. So I never read. Because, you know, I'd
well, that read, seems healthy.
Yeah, I'd read the back of the cornflakes packet at breakfast. When she's away, I do read. Anyway, you can read it over your cup of morning coffee, if you like, instead. They're quite short, and they're good introductions to all sorts of topics. So I do commend those to you, actually. Yeah, and I've written a few books, which you can see listed in the shop there as well, on climate change and sustainable living and the new creation and disasters, that sort of thing, which is my professional expertise. Well, I know a little bit about it.
Yeah. Brilliant. Well, we'll include a link to the Faraday Institute in the show notes of the podcast. There's also, as always, lots of stuff on Dad's website. That's johnwyatt.com to read and further prompt your own thinking. Particularly on the kind of medical ethics side. And if you'd like to find some of my journalism, you can go to my website, tswyatt.com. And in particular, I recommend you sign up to my weekly newsletter, church news newsletter called The Critical Friend, for free. That's it. Thanks so much, Bob. Thanks everyone for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.